We're talking to labor leaders about the history of their unions, their personal history, and maybe where things are going. And I'm sitting here with Rich Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO. Rich, thanks for sitting down with us.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it, Rich.
You know, you look at the history of the labor movement in this country, one of struggle, one of violence, one of bloodshed. And I think a lot of this generation's forgotten or deliberately not been taught that history.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And the battle still goes on, and the destruction of workers still go on. It's just a different forum now. They used to have armed thugs that would shoot you if you tried to organize, and now they starve you out or make you work for starvation wages. And it's a concentrated effort to eliminate the labor movement right now.
Now, you're one of the guys who, you know, you fought some of these battles. I think back to the time when you were president of the UMWA and some of the violent battle of that era that weren't all that long ago.
No. I mean, back in the 80s, 90s, and even the turn of this century, we were still having those type of battles in West Virginia, Kentucky, Virginia, and other places around the country. Because workers are always struggling to get a voice.
You know, I remember we had done a labor history tour a couple years back, and we went into Blair, West Virginia, and, you know, to talk about the Battle of Blair Mountain. And even then, the people who lived there were still defending the coal industry against those battles. And I'm kind of struck at, you know, how easily we've forgotten that history.
Well, think about it. They used to teach labor history in grade school and high school. Those courses are gone right now. That didn't fit in with the overall theme of trying to remove labor from the playing field, to have them talking about what we do. You know, we represent workers. We give workers a voice. We raise wages. We increase benefits. We give people job security. And we're a big part of the community because we're also football coaches and little league coaches and scout masters and all kind of different volunteers through our churches. That's what the labor movement does. And if no one knows about it, they can paint you any way they want.
What do you say to the
struggle?
Right. What do you say to the person who goes, well, you know, all of those coal wars and all of the pitch battles with the militia and the National Guard, that's in the past. We're better than that now. How do you respond to that?
Unless you know where you came from, you don't know where you're going to. Those battles set the floor for everybody that people are still enjoying today. It's good to know what can happen when capital becomes unbridled or so strong that it's answerable to no one. It's important to know that.
Right.
Especially in a democracy, it's important to know that.
And it's that original battle between the organized capital and organized labor.
It is, but it's going even more than that right now. Right now it's about political ideology. You have people like the Koch brothers who spend $1 billion trying to elect people to do lessen benefits, lower wages, take away job security, take away the voice of workers on the job, in the community, or in the state or federal level, quite frankly.
Yeah, I mean, because you go back to that, and I, you know, in my lifetime, you've seen this really just all-out attack on organized labor. When I started in the workforce, organized labor was about a quarter of the population, of the work population, and now it's down to about 11%. And, you know, look, there are people who want to completely extinguish people's right to collective bargaining, people's right to a voice on the job.
That's their plan. It's not just that they want to. It's their plan, and they're acting on it. There are attacks on workers in 26 or 27 states right now to take away the right to bargain collectively so that people have a voice on the job and can get a bigger share. Take away things like prevailing wages and Davis-Bacon. Davis-Bacon was an act that was passed. Davis was a Republican. Bacon was a Republican. It was signed by Herbert Hoover. And the idea behind Davis-Bacon is we shouldn't use taxpayers' dollars to drive down their wages so that when the government comes in, whether it's local, state, or federal government, they should pay the wage that prevails in that community so they're not lowering our standards with our tax dollars. And they're trying to do away with all of that.
Yeah, well, and not just that. You want to have a local construction industry. You want to have local, you know, skilled tradesmen. You don't want transient labor coming through and leaving shoddy work behind either. At least that's my thought.
Well, that's the best secret in the country right now, Rick, is that the labor movement, other than the U.S. military, the labor movement trains more people every year than any university or anybody else out there. we have skilled people, and we bring our journey people back in, and we give them retraining constantly so that we're the most skilled people out there, and they ought to be able to do that job. They ought to be able to get a fair wage for that, doing that job.
Right, but here, you know, just recently the House Republicans passed the Working Families Flexibility Act, and I'm sure you've seen this. And I've been telling people this is the end of the eight-hour day, which people literally died for. It's the end of it.
My union still celebrates the mine workers. We still celebrate the eight-hour day on April 1st. It was the first one negotiated by one of my predecessors, Johnny Mitchell, who was a president of the mine workers. Came out of the anthracite region, and he negotiated the first eight-hour workday. And then overtime was predicated on time after 8 hours. Now they want to take that away and say, you work 16 today, and I'll give you off second Tuesday of next month. We'll give you that day off. And so you never get overtime, and your standards get lowered. Or you can be made to work way beyond 8 hours. How do people plan for that? How do single parents plan to pick up their kids? How do you plan with rides? How do you plan your life around that when you never know what your schedule is going to be?
But here's the thing, and I hear this a lot from people. We need more flexibility because this is a different economy. You know, the old industrial economy, we had the big factories and all that. That was a different economy. And I go back to, you know, it may be different, but it's the same. You're still working. You're still trying to support your family. And, you know, how much is an hour of your life worth?
Well, first of all, let me start off with this premise. We are the richest nation on the face of the earth at our most rich point in history. Corporations have had 3 years of record profits, breaking profits each year higher and higher, and it will continue this year. They're doing that without these changes that they say are absolutely necessary. Having some predictability in one's life is important to a worker, whether you're a management person or whether you're a union person. You have to be able to pick up the kids, to do shopping, have a doctor's appointment, do all of those things, and this would eliminate that. The notice of a flexible workforce, our workforces bend over backwards to meet those kind of needs, but they do it with some predictability and something that benefits them. The people that say they need this, all they want is the unfettered right to control the lives of those workers without the worker having any say. That's simply not going to happen.
Yeah. I keep saying that, you know, the reality is the wealth class of this country wants to move us back to the 80s and 90s and not the 1980s and 90s.
1890s, yeah.
Absolutely, because you go back and you look at the Lochner era, you look at, you know, the era where we couldn't pass maximum hour laws, no minimum wage laws.
Child labor laws.
Any of that stuff. And it just seems to me, you know, as someone who studies the history of labor, all of those battles, all of those struggles are going to have to be refought again. And I think it's going to be much worse this time. Just my sense.
Well, it's going to be much worse because, look, the economy, everybody thinks the economy is like the weather. The economy is not like the weather. The economy is nothing but a set of rules. Those rules are made by the men and women that we elect. Those rules decide the winners and the losers. And those rules have been written against workers for 4 or 5 decades now. So there's a real imbalance in this country, an imbalance of power. Corporate America is way too strong and workers are way too weak. That means that you're going to have continuing dropping of wages, lowering of benefits, and the demand to have from the politicians that can be elected because of cases like Citizens Action, where corporations can put unlimited amounts of money into the election process, you're going to have them writing laws that do the same. So the rules will always be stacked against the workers unless we break out of that mold. That's what we're trying to do right now.
Right, but
break out of the mold.
At some point, it comes back to us, though, because I think back to my grandparents' generation. My grandfather was a Teamster for 30 years, and he talked of the battles that they fought to move him from making 17 cents an hour working 20 hours a week on the back of a coal truck to a solidly middle-class sure. lifestyle and dignity in retirement. He talked about those battles and, you know, the solidarity that those workers felt amongst each other. And I think this generation has to rediscover that word, solidarity.
I think that's right. But let me point out a study that just happened. Harvard just did a study that said if you were born after 1980, only 30% of those born after 1980 support a democratic form of government. And 24% of those people born after 1980 think a democratic form of government is bad. Now you could say, why is that? It's because they've lived in an economy that has never worked for them. The rules that were written have always been written against them. So they get saddled with unlimited debt from their education. They can't find a full-time job. They work with three or four people each day, and they can't get ahead no matter what they do. They're losing faith in that system. And unless we all recognize as a nation that that's a threat to the continuation of this nation, we're walking ourselves to the edge of a cliff, because there will come a point when more people are not served by the economy than are served by it, and they will take steps to change it.
Yeah.
What we're trying to do is reestablish that ladder to the middle class that we did in the 30s, 40s, and 50s when we had a lot of organizing battles. And then when we were 35% of the workforce, we were driving wages for everybody. So if the union got a raise, a non-union contractor got a raise as well.
Right.
They had to give them a raise.
Well, even I remember when I started working, you know, the bosses, the supervisors, they wanted the union to do well because they got equal raises as well. So if the union did well at the bargaining table, their wages went up. And it reverberated across the economy, just like as wages are stagnated and declined, it's happened all across the economy.
Absolutely.
So the question then becomes, at what point do we say we've had enough? Because I look at this last election in 2016. The anger that the Trump voters felt, I believe, is real. I grew up in Cleveland.
Yeah.
My lifetime, you saw deindustrialization happen. You saw that white working class worker who got a job at the factory now, you know, working for minimum wage somewhere. That anger is real. How do we take that anger and say, you know what? What got us to this point is exactly the person and the policies that they're perpetuating to this day.
See, I think the last election, a majority of workers voted to rewrite the rules of the economy for the reasons you just stated. You know, the trade rules, the tax rules, all of those things were decided for us to be losers and Wall Street and the rich to be winners. So they wanted to change them. And they looked at the two candidates. And some voted for Hillary Clinton and said, she's the person who will change. And a bunch of them voted for Donald Trump and said, we think this guy, as unorthodox as he is, and no matter all his faults, he'll at least give us a chance at change. So they voted for him, and they're expecting change. The problem is the agenda that Trump talked about is being hijacked by the Wall Street wing of his administration. They're hijacking all the things that caused workers to vote for him. He said, we're going to have new trade rules. We're going to change trade. I'm going to do away with NAFTA. I'm going to call China a currency manipulator on day one. I'm going to bring back manufacturing. I'm going to bring back autos. I'm going to bring back this. And they believed it, at least said, at least we have a chance. And now what he's doing, in many instances, is the exact opposite. It's the exact opposite because the Wall Street wing, that is, invades, it seems like it invades every administration here, has taken over, and they're pulling his agenda away from that. We're caused workers to vote for him in the first place.
Now, it's interesting to me, though, that you look at the repeal and replace plan actually harms most of the Trump voters because, you know, those are the
24 million of them.
Those are the lower income working class people who are able to get health care, you know, maybe for the first time.
Yeah, disabled, the elderly. Yeah, 24 million people will lose health care. They're starting to understand that now, and that's why you saw that the first bill that the Republicans brought up had such little support. 70-some percent of the American public said, that's bad, no. You'll see the same thing whenever a bill comes up in the Senate. If it does the same thing the House bill did, drops $24 million, eliminates essentially the requirement that you have to cover pre-existing conditions because they can charge for it. They can drop out all the necessary elements of a plan that had to be in there before because of the law. They're all now gone, and they don't have to give you emergency care. They don't have to give you prenatal care. They don't have to give you any of the things that are necessary for a health care bill to do. And when the American public finds out about this, I think it's their albatross. I think this is what will cause the American people to say, we've had enough. You had both houses of government. You had the House, you had the Senate, you had a chance to make this right, and this is what you give us?
Well, isn't it their ideology, though? I mean, pay or die is the theory. If you don't have the wealth to be able to pay for the access or for the insurance, you shouldn't get it. That's the yeah. theory. You know, I go back to, you know, I think of, you know, Zach Womp, the congressman from Tennessee, who famously said Volkswagen invested in Tennessee, a right-to-work state with lower wages and less health care. And that, to me, goes back to that's their ideology. Less for working people, more for the 1%, more for the corporations, more for the wealthy.
Yeah. Remember, the haves invented the have-a-littles to prevent the have-nots from taking from the haves. And that have-a-littles was the middle class. And that middle class is disappearing. So the threat is starting to grow from the have-nots. Whether they voted for Trump or they voted for Hillary Clinton, they're not going to be shut out and have an economy that doesn't work for them for very much longer.
So let me ask you, as the head of the American of the AFL-CIO here, the future is uncertain for a lot of workers. And, you know, you go back and you look at those struggles and the battles of the past, the lessons that you learn from those. Where do we move forward? How do we take this and move forward to where we have that prosperous working class again, to where people can, you know, work hard, play by the rules, that American dream that I grew up believing in? How do we move back to that?
Well, here's what we're fighting for. We believe that every worker has a right to a good job and the power to be able to increase wages, increase benefits, and increase retirement security, whether you're in a union or not. We believe that non-union workers should be able to come together, demand that their boss sit down and negotiate with them so that they get a raise. That's the only way we're going to eliminate inequality in this country. Look, our economy is 72% driven by consumer spending.
Right.
If consumers don't have money in their pocket, they can't spend. They don't spend. They don't create demand. They don't create demand. No jobs get created. So what we have to do is give them some money. And the best way to do that is to give them a voice on the job and say to a non-union worker, you don't have to be in a union. You should be able to sit down with your fellow employees and negotiate with your boss for better wages and benefits and retirement security. Now, some will say, don't we have that right? And the answer is, no, you don't. Because unless you have a union, the employer right now doesn't have to negotiate with you.
But we're told all the time that you can make your own deal. So that runs counter to what I'm being told. You can make your own deal, Rich.
Yeah, okay, let me give you an example. Jack Welch walks in the room when he's the head of GE. And you walk in the room with him. And you say, you know, Jack, I've done a great job.
You're fired.
Give me a wage increase. Probably fired. Or at least he snickers and walks on and doesn't give you another thought.
You're fired because you called him Jack.
Well, you don't have the ability as an individual worker to change that.
Right.
And a lot of people think, well, I'm the best. And then they get screwed over. And they say, gee, being the best and doing a good job for 25 years didn't stop them from moving my plant to Mexico or Chile or Russia or anywhere, or China or anywhere else. I got left behind as well. So the only way to do that is to come together. Have a collective voice, use your collective power, whether you have a union or not, use that power to get higher wages.
And better working conditions, back to the beginning.
Health
better
and
wages,
safety,
hours, conditions.
Health and safety. Because look what you have right now. You got undocumented workforce that really gets screwed. They misclassify them. They cheat them out of wages. Don't give them overtime. Make them work in the most unsafe conditions possible. And the instant they say anything, they deport them, they whack them, send them out. And that employer that hires those people, it competes against your employer who pays you decent wages, overtime, and good conditions, and your employer loses all the time in the marketplace. So what we have to do is give those undocumented workers rights so that they can get the same rights and force their employer to play by the same rules as your employer.
Absolutely. I mean, it just makes common sense, but somehow we've gotten into this world where it's the least restrictive trade barrier. It's the least amount of wages and benefits. It just seems we're heading down the wrong path.
Those are rules. That's what the rules mandate and allow. That's why we have to change the rules of the economy and not let anybody believe that the economy is like the weather. There's nothing you can do about it. Trade rules, tax rules, manufacturing rules, all the rules that affect workers' lives, health and safety rules, beryllium, so you don't have to work in unsafe conditions, silica rules, dust standards, all the things that are out there, those are the rules that you have to live by and understand you can change them.
But, Rich, those are job-killing regulations. Those are job killers.
You know what? I once sat with an employer. An employer said, when we were doing the Mine Reclamation Act, and they were going to have to reclaim the land that they stripped, and he told me, if you force us to do that, we'll be out of business. And I looked at him, and I said, maybe if you can't do that, just maybe you should be out of business.
Exactly.
Because we have to live in that scarred land. We have to have our water polluted, worry about slides and everything else. You can do better. And they were forced to do better. And the industry was better. It was a better member of the community. And God only knows they prospered after that. That's the same argument we always hear. Take away these regulations because they kill jobs. No, take away the regulations will kill people. Because they'll be forced to work in unsafe conditions. Take away the regulations and you'll have the environment will be denigrated. And you'll die earlier and your kids will die earlier because you have to breathe that air. The regulations that have been put in place, by and large, have forced companies to stop doing the most outrageous acts that affect society. Whether it's polluting a river, polluting the air, or making a worker work in a coal mine with unsafe top, they're all the same. And those regulations save lives and make an employer a better member of the community.
I always say that, you know, it seems like they want to move us back to the days where people are desperate enough, hungry enough, and their kids are starving, that they'll work in those deplorable conditions for poverty wages. So last question I've got for you, in moving forward, what's the marching order? Because right now we're seeing thousands of people in the streets all across the country. How do we bring them in? What's the marching order going forward?
Well, what we're doing is an outreach. We're outreaching to progressive groups, like-minded progressive groups, whether they're women's groups, whether they're environmental groups, whether they're manufacturing groups, anybody who's out there, to try to harness that energy that's out there. Because you see a lot of momentum, and you see collectivism or people coming together. You see that on the growth right now. The good news, Rick, is that Americans, by a larger number each year, look at unions as a solution to the problem. So rather than killing us off, it's actually making us more popular because we're the ones that stand up to defend those things. And we'll continue to do that. Coming together with like-minded progressive groups, we've invited them into our board meetings. We've invited them into our conventions. We've invited them in to our strategy sessions. We are working together to give the American people the facts, to teach them how things like neoliberalism and austerity programs are designed to hurt them. Because they should never, never forget this one point. We're the richest nation on the face of the earth at our most richest point in history. It's not that we don't have the resources to be able to provide good jobs, health care for everybody, a secure retirement, clean air, clean water, a quality education. We can do those things if we have the political will. That's where solidarity comes together. It's an old concept that has absolute meaning right now, probably more meaning than ever. Come together, act together, we win together.
There you go. Stand shoulder to shoulder. Rich Trumka, I appreciate you taking time for us. We'd like to hear what you think. Send us an email, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Thanks so much.